For nature.
For the ocean.
For people.
For animals.
Okay, hey.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, welcome, beautiful Suns Planet community. And I want to introduce you today to a very special guest, very different podcast today than the other podcasts you have seen from me the last times. This is Joe Diomede. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Hello. Maggie, I don't even know your surname, but...
Yes, you can't maybe not even pronounce it.
Okay, that's fine.
It's called Schnitzer, but it's very hard to say. But why do I interview Joe? Well, Joe is one of these people I met here in France. I'm sitting right now here on your place, in your place.
Yeah.
We just had the tent on your ground there behind the computer and slept here tonight. And Joe is a cyclist. He's a world traveler. He's a blogger. An author. He wrote many books. Like, one is called Cycles of a Traveler. It's amazing, this book. I just have it at home. I did not read it yet, I have to say. It's very big. I have to start it, but it's a very big book. Joe cycled around the whole world with his bicycle for many years, and I wanted to show you today that there are so many people out there which are living in a different lifestyle, which have a bit of a different view on the world and not just following the system blind. And there are many, many options how we can live different in this world and how much difference we can produce every single day with our choices.
We can make a difference to the world.
We can make a difference, Joe. And this is so amazing that you're here. Thank you for taking your time.
Yeah, it's fine. I have lots of time.
We have
time richness. Time richness is good.
That's the thing what you enjoy a lot, right? The time. That's how you live your life, enjoying time. As well with your family, I can see that. Your family is right now planting trees there right in front of us.
Yeah. We've got the bread oven.
Yes,
for pizza,
bread oven
pizza
is on.
For lunch.
Pizza for lunch. We share a lot of time. You share a lot of time with your family, and you did that all of your life.
I've done it most of my life. I'm approaching 60 right now, and like friends that I grew up with or relatives are talking about retirement age. I started my retirement from the working world the day I graduated university in 1983. I was a young guy, grew up in the Bronx, the section of New York that many people unfortunately know for the wrong reasons. It's not as dangerous as everyone says. But yeah, I did see some untimely deaths in my day growing up there. Some violent and some, but it wasn't a really violent part of the world, but there were some unfortunate incidences there. But my dad died when I was 17. And I think that really took that was one of those changing points. One of those moments you wake up, I was 17, he was 57. And he had he just had an aneurysm. Boom, he went to work. I said goodbye to him, went to school, came back. He was dead. My life has changed. So I mean, my life didn't change as much as his plans on my mother. Oh, when I'm 60, I'm going to do this. And we're going to do that. And I just decided not to put my life on hold. So a few years after that, I graduated. I was just finishing high school, and I was going to go into university. And I started, again, we didn't have a lot of money, went to a city university. And in those years, my eyes were opened to a whole different world. I grew up in a very strict Catholic school environment. And all of a sudden, I was in a city university in New York. Very, very big shift. In the late 70s, early 80s. So it was a very cool moment to be there with the clubbing that was going on and everything that was happening. And when I was I got into motorcycles and I realized I wanted to go across America on a motorcycle. So when I graduated university, where my friends were going, what are you going to do now with your degree? I said, I'm going to fold it, put it right there and see maybe someday in the future. But I studied communications and radio. Oh,
well, you're very good in communications.
Yes. Well, I studied it and it was funny. Even at the time then, I studied it to understand the work that I saw the manipulation even then, you know. So I was like, this is interesting. How does this work? How does media work? And I looked into it deeper, you know, so we had to study it from a different side, the radio, television, print advertising, everything. And just, it was all about manipulation. And I didn't want to work in it. But after 4 years, I was very interested that I had this knowledge. So I got on my motorcycle, went across America with a buddy who I talked into selling his car and buying a motorcycle and coming with me. Easy Rider, woo, but not the ending. Yeah, not the ending of Easy Rider, but you know, the first bit of discovering America. And we did, and I got back. He couldn't wait to get back to New York. For him, it was a trip, home, work. Cool. He loved his work. He loved what he studied.
He missed home.
He missed the East Coast. And understandably, it's a great place.
You just wanted to go on.
And for me, I just wanted, that just was just the taster. So I worked for a year. I was broke. I was just a young 21-year-old kid. I blew it was $800 in my pocket for that first trip, you know. And I came back and I just saved money. I worked as a bartender and I worked as a land surveyor and I did whatever I could do. And then, you know, 9 months later, I was on my motorcycle again, going across America alone. And then that's when I started realizing that life and the universe does provide if you ask it to, you know. And I was just the dude from the Bronx still, you know. It was just like, you know, I wasn't really, I read, okay, a little bit of Kerouac. Richard Bach at the time was very big. And, you know, a few of his books that touched me spiritually, Robert Persig with Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, you know, stuff that people were giving me because I was going on motorcycle. They were like, oh, Joe, you'd love this and this. And they were starting to open me up and I was starting to change, especially when you're on a motorcycle and you have open-ended travel. If no one out here has ever had done an open-ended travel, I highly suggest it.
Yes. I travel with a bike for 3 months in America, but I wished it was an open-ended.
Right. Open-ended.
So beautiful.
3 months sounds like a long time.
No, you just
a year sounds like a long time. Open-ended. It doesn't mean you have to go for a year or 3 months. Open-ended journey might end in 2 weeks, but it's going to change you a lot more than that 2 month journey where you know you have to be back to work because it just lays there. I know, and I'm speaking, you know, people always say to me, yeah, but Joe, it's easy for you. And I always laugh at that because I made tough decisions. You know, I wound up raising my children away from grandparents in a part of the world where I didn't speak the language, had to learn French because we didn't want to get into debt. We didn't want to, you know, so we moved to the South France, a small village where we could buy a house with the money we scrimped and saved with. So I could have
where
that time.
Where we are right now.
So where we are right now. And
amazing. You know, and a beautiful van.
We live in a small little house down there. The van is a traveler's van a friend gave me. We transformed it. So we just learned how to be easy with our money. So we didn't have to work for money. And once we scrubbed debt from our life, which by the way, my wife and I never subscribed, got into that luckily because I had traveled and I lived an easy life and I taught English in Japan. And so all those things showed me that debt was the big tie to conform to a life that maybe everyone is not following their heart for. And I understand it. It's the story we're fed. It's the story that everyone follows.
Yes,
and it's the story your neighbors follow, your friends follow. And it's hard to break out of. And luckily, by chance, I had a very strong personality ever since a young age. I questioned things and, you know, the things against my parents' wishes, you know, quit the altar boys growing up Catholic and you know, just doing stuff like that where people go, oh, but you don't do stuff like that. And I was like, oh, really? Sorry, I just did.
I did it.
And look, I'm still alive. You know, and so, you know, and that was the same thing with the motorcycle journey. It's like, you're going to take a motorcycle journey across America? And when I come back, they were like, oh, so you're done now? I was like, yeah, I'm done until I save enough to do another one. And so and then on this, and then on the second one, it's when things really started opening up to me.
Because the next one was then on the bike.
No, it wasn't on the bike yet. I was a pretty dedicated motorcyclist in America. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I had my motorcycle that, again, the universe provided. It was, I won't go into that story, but you know, it found me, like many things in life. You know, the motorcycle found me, the exact color, size, and brand I wanted that people told me didn't exist in that size. And then all of a sudden I had it. So I was on that motorcycle on the second trip when I started not looking at maps so much. I knew where I was heading, California. So if the sun was blinding me by 4 PM, I was going the right way. If the sun was in my mirrors, I was like, Joe, something's wrong here, Joe. So but it led me to some interesting places. Like one time, the end of a ferry port, the end of a road that landed in a ferry port. And I was like, oh, where am I? Oh, okay. That was good, Joe. So I had to actually take a ferry to reconnect with a different part of Canada to continue the journey. But no mistakes, people. There are no mistakes out there because that ferry put me on all the motorcycles in front. And when we got off the ferry, I got off with a guy who was loading his motorcycle up and we started talking where you're headed. And I was headed to a place called Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. And he was headed to the place called Sault Ste. Marie, Canada, which was on Ontario, which is on the other side of the border. So he said, oh, I'm going to my grandparents for lunch. Do you want to join me? I was like, sure. So we went there and I'm making this story a little long because it's very pertinent. Went there, we had his mother was a motorcyclist, grandmother was an ex-motorcyclist, telling her about her voyages in the 60s. And it's like, you know, for a young 22-year-old on the second voyage across America to meet, like,
you don't find, you know,
no, it's like, whoa. So we had, and then she just, as a secondary thought, kind of before I was leaving for the night, I said, oh, by the way, she was speaking to Frank, which was the guy I met on the motorcycle. He said, your brother John was here last week with his friend Lewis, and they were going across Canada on their motorcycles. And because she was a motorcyclist, she said it was a BSA and a Kawasaki, because, you know, as when you're in a certain world, those things matter. A lot of people say motorcycle, you know, and which is fine. And I just, it was in the mental box. And so anyway, I continued on my journey and I was having a great time. You know, it was like, the first trip was great with my friend, but this was freedom. Again, it was the open-ended part of it. B, I had no one to discuss if I made a left, made a right, felt like sleeping
you
in a field, wanted to go to a cheap hotel. And, you know, call it selfish if you want, but for a young person finding my way, it was so nice to know that every decision I made was my choice. Mm-hmm. And if I screwed up like ending at the Georgian Bay, I could try to find the positive side. And I'm an optimist, you know, not only because I'm American, just naturally. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't get worried when I was like, oh, I'm on a ferry. Oh, well, I'm at a dead end. Oh, well, you know, so
let's end up somewhere else.
So I went across America, had a great time camping. And when I got to the West Coast, I met a couple of people here and there that I rode for a day with, or maybe one guy I'd had a little bit of a bad feeling with. So I just said, I'm going to stay here for now. You head on, you know, I started finding instincts that are deadened when you live in this prescribed world. Here's your next job. Here's what you do. So we're taught to like, let go of our instincts. Whereas, you know, following your instincts is a thing we have to recultivate. And I started following my instincts. And
that's very important, not just for all the stories you have to tell, because you have so many, but as well for people to feel more what their instincts tell them, to not follow blind. Because I think that most people are becoming followers.
Yes.
We are following our surroundings, following our parents, following our decisions of our friends.
And it's designed into modern day vocabulary.
Yes.
You know, if you're on Instagram, what do? You follow somebody. On Facebook, what do you do? How many followers do you have? Yes. No, leaders. We have to be leaders. Yes. Leaders of our own lives, not just followers, you know, just sitting behind a computer, following, looking at all these wonderful lives around us. I get to the West Coast. Exactly. Yes. Create your own. So I get to the West Coast and I'm starting to feel, I'm getting goosebumps as I tell the story, because I'm starting to feel like, oh, I wouldn't mind camping with a few guys for a couple of days now and just have a little camaraderie. Yeah, I've been on the road thousands of miles on my own and it was great. The novelty was still there, but I was like, yeah, it's always nice to also share time with people. And I on the coast of Oregon, and I went past, you know, I knew exactly when I had to get petrol in my motorcycle because I was on it. It was my buddy. You know, I knew, okay, 250 miles. Better start looking for a gas station. A gas station, as we call it in America. So I passed one and something, don't know, whatever, said, oh, Joe, get some gas in that gas station. And I looked at, you know, I had this feeling, this overwhelming feeling. I looked at my odometer and was like, 120 miles. I'm not even halfway there. And I kept on going. And something, I just made a U-turn. Mm-hmm. I just made a U-turn.
I went and
I filled up. And I was pulling out. As I was just about to start the engine to pull out, I hear two motorcycles. I hear the engine. I hear the rumble of the engines. And I look, and, you know, being a motorcyclist, I was like, all right, those sounds like different type of engine. I look, oh, wow, loaded. Maybe they're not locals out for a ride. So I kind of wait the 3 minutes until I pull in, or 2 minutes, whatever, and BSA Kawasaki. Like, and I was like, okay, they were going across Canada. I'm in Oregon, not that far, but that would be a crazy coincidence. I walk around the back of the bikes, Ontario license plates. So I go up to the guy on the BSA and I said, John. And he looked at me and said, Joe. Do I know you? No, he didn't know me. he said, yeah. I said, John Westlaken. And he said, do I know you? I said, no, but I had dinner with your brother and your grandmother back in Sault Ste. Marie. And we traveled 4 or 5 days together. Nice. And we camped down and we're still friends to this day. Mm-hmm. And we just had a great time and we lost each other. This is the day before mobile phones. We were in a big city. They had to get money. I stopped at a red light. They went through it, didn't realize I was gone. It was a big city. We were on country roads. I lost them. We never found each other until 25 years later. It was the next time I spoke to him.
Wow.
And we remained friends. But that was the beauty. It was the natural thing. Yeah. It wasn't like I had to go around the city and look for them, or I had the email address. I had no contact.
Yes. Yeah,
and I had great memories, and we went on, and
there we are already. We can already go into the part of this why we have this here today, because you are there's written give it away, right?
Give it a go.
Yeah, sorry, give it a go, give it a go,
give it a go, give it away.
Give it away.
That's our red hot chili peppers.
We have many. We give them away then. Afterwards. No, give it a go. What is that? Tell me about this, because this is an amazing thing. You are a person who loves to be in contact with people, to talk with people. And when you look around, people are always on the phone, just on their computers.
Exactly. And well, I mean, fortunately, where we live, not. And yeah, so anyway, life brought me on a fantastic journey and with all these different choices that I've made. And then when I met my wife on the Tibetan Plateau, but you got to read the book to find out all the other stories.
Yeah,
but
many incredible stories.
But yeah. We met, it's actually four books in one, so you could always put it down and come back to it. But anyway, we wound up in the south of France, where people weren't addicted, you know, to social media as much as they were in other parts of the world. And I left to go see a friend who was happens to be a famous guy in England, to see him play at a stadium. And I was walking there, and everyone in London was like this. And on the metro, no one was talking. And here, like, you go to my market, which Maggie can attest to.
It's amazing.
People go there.
We meet, we talk.
And you know, smartphones only arrived here 4 or 5 years ago. So a lot of the young people, you know, of course, it's quick to get the addiction. But it's not part of their childhood, mm-hmm. the 17, 18 year olds. Yeah. The younger ones maybe more, unfortunately. Yeah, yeah. But when I looked around, I was like, wow. And then I went to the small town, smaller town where my wife was raised, and I was walking the streets there. I saw five kids at a bus station, all on their smartphones. And then it hit me. I was like, okay, something's wrong.
I mean, you know that situation too.
Yes, everyone does. If you live in a big city, you know the silent cars now on the train and people on their tablets.
Yeah.
And I said, but every time I stop someone in London to ask directions to the Palladium, or in Weymouth just to say hi, ooh, a bit breezy today, boom, they would stop, say, hey, where are you from? And they hear the accent, we'd have a chat, we'd make a connection. And that was it. You know, we didn't have to exchange numbers to be friends for life.
Yes, yes.
We just have a bit of humanitarian contact, you know?
Yes, yes.
And which is lovely. It kind of brightens your day, fills your heart with oxytocin, and you yes, got love for the world, which is good.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Love again.
But I was like, I was walking around saying, okay, people want to connect, but they're, you know, we have these addictive devices, and I'm not saying I don't have it either. And I could see the addiction to it, and I consciously try to leave it. And so I said, okay, maybe a t-shirt, like say, hey, hug me, or I'll talk to you. But I was like, nah, too big. So I came up with the idea of a little badge that gives you permission to have a conversation, because it doesn't really mean something exactly. It's called Give It A Go. So people would say, give what a go? And then I just say that. Mm-hmm. And the conversation's open, and then we go from there. And I always have more badges to hand out, and everyone loves it. And that same friend, as the universe does provide, that same friend who happens to be very famous, he was one of my first pictures with the badge on, and he got behind the project. And after COVID, because all his stadium shows were canceled, and he saw that there was a real need for people to reconnect again. And I sent him this little book I wrote about how I arrive at this Give It A Go project. Mm-hmm. And I sent it to him, and he read it, and he's like, Joe, I want to take it a step further. I want to start giving out badges at the concerts. I want to start people not feeling so tentative, especially post COVID and all the other things going on. I want them to feel that they connect to somebody, and it gives them something in common. Oh, well, you were at the show last night. I was at the show. And so, yeah. And then if it could grow and become a known thing and connect people, we're losing that connection, and we can't lose the connection.
Yeah.
And that's the most important thing.
I think so too.
For the world, for us humans. We have many divisive issues going around down here. But if we get right down to it, if we can get past the divisiveness, we have a lot in common with our fellow brethren and sisters on the planet.
You know, yes. Like, we just don't give it enough a go.
No.
We don't try anymore, because we have so much on our phones we carry around with us without looking around what is happening around us. It's so beautiful. There's so many, so much variety, so many different people.
Sure.
We can open ourselves for different opinions, different points of views, different lifestyles.
And to get through the day right now is almost a chore for some people, especially if you live in a city, and if you're dealing with, maybe if you live in a country or a place where there's vaccine passports and you got to make a decision on that, and then you have to have a conversation about that. And, you know, Bruno, that's it. Bruno. Puma's just going, yeah, what are you guys talking about? I'm just a dog, man. And it's that connection. When I got rid of my motorcycle, I moved to Japan, and I was still a motorcyclist in my head, and I was on the way to a motorcycle shop to buy a motorcycle. I used motorcycle with a friend, Bruno. That's where I was in my head. Bruno, who I was going to see, he was a motorcyclist we met at the English language school I had gotten a job in. And we stopped at a red light, just, you know, a random red light. And just to the left was a bicycle shop. I happened to look to the left, and I saw my first mountain bike ever. This is in the late 80s. And I was like, what is that? Straight handlebars, fat tires. So I said, Bruno, can we just check the shop out? He goes, yeah, yeah. I walked in, I saw a mountain bike. All the money I had in my pockets of my used motorcycle, I plunked it down on a high-end mountain bike. My friend Bruno thought it was crazy.
Okay, what
and I said, no, Bruno, this is the direction my life is taken. This was meant to, yeah. I've been wanting to get away from, you know, I never lived in debt, and I didn't want to be drawn on my travels to a petrol station and a flat tire that would necessitate me hitchhiking and getting a tow truck, because you can't fix a flat tire on the side of the road unless you're really, really clever on a motorcycle and have lots of big tools. So with the bike, it was autonomy, it was freedom, and it just took it to a different level, and it changed the direction of my life.
And it makes visible your whole lifestyle, like being more
autonomous. Yeah,
exactly. Right. I mean, everything what you do, like how you live here with your garden, with your own veggies, with your lifestyle, this is all connected.
Right? Yeah.
It shows it up.
It helped bring me there. You know, again, I was still, I keep on saying this guy from the Bronx thing, but it's not the Bronx, LA, pick a big city. I was just a city kid. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up with the convenience of, you know, the subway, movie theaters, you know, everything was there for me. And so when I started choosing to live a little bit differently, and I saw that all the attachments that came with that sort of lifestyle, friends were getting into jobs and debt already at 25 and 26. And I was still living on my motorcycles, then turned into a bicycle, had money in my pocket, was free. And then the bicycle just changed so much. Mm. And, you know, actually, that same bicycle, there you go, mate.
There it is.
You know, has gone through a few changes because I did like to drop handlebars and I missed it. And that wasn't the exact bike I bought in Japan that day, because that one broke, but I changed the frame. But a lot of that equipment is actually some of the original equipment bought in 1987. And, you know, there it is. Change the tires, I change cables, and I still do tours on it now in this area.
And that's something really interesting as well. As there are so many people, I see today, every kid nowadays has a normal bike, has an electrical bike, has an electrical roller, has a, I don't know how many things. We don't teach the kids even to fix it themselves. We just buy a new one. And when it's broken, we throw it, we buy a new one.
Yeah.
This whole throwing away society, this is insane. And this is a problem. And this is exactly why we are talking about this topic too. Like fixing your own things, trying to find, like yesterday we made a barbecue and we did not have everything there to make the barbecue. So we missed some stuff like the grill.
Like the grill, that's right there. About a meter from us as we speak.
You came with the bike to the barbecue. You found the bucket.
I found the bucket on the side of the road. I found some branches. Yeah.
We found some stuff from a broken roof. We made our own grill.
Yeah.
You make things with what you find, what you have. And this is what was so beautiful yesterday, because I think that many people just forgot, and me too. We forgot how to use what we have.
Be creative.
We always try to buy new things, and it has to be perfect when we buy it, and we buy new when we don't know anymore how to deal with this because it's getting old.
And people wear it as a badge. I mean, I worked in a rich suburb. So as my life did change, I started working in bicycle shops. So to fund my ship, my trips, it was no longer like, oh, bartending and this and that. Because again, even drinking alcohol and a lot of those things just fell off of my plate because I was so conscious and so aware and enjoy. I was on drugs all the time, you know, because I was just like,
yes, because it's life.
I was like, wow, whoa, I'm cycling up the Tibetan plateau.
So
you know, I'm hitchhiking on boats throughout the Indonesian islands. What is going on? You know? Mm-hmm. And, but it was just happening. Mm-hmm. And I worked in a rich suburb of New York, whatever, 25 years ago. And a lawyer, this is not to say lawyers are bad. I happen to remember he was a lawyer. And he comes into the shop with his then 12-year-old son. And can you fix his flat? Puncture. And I said, yeah, sure. I said, but, you know, at the time, I said, it's going to be $8 if I fix a flat. I can sell you a patch kit. And, you know, it's like $150 and you can fix like 7 flats. And, you know, because here I'm just going to replace the tube because we don't have time to do it. You know, we don't, you know, the boss says we don't fix flats, we give them new tubes. Of course, I save every single, I have a truckload of tubes because they're like, okay, I'll keep that. And the guy looked me squarely in the eye and said, my son will never fix his own flats.
Wow.
And
well, then
I said,
his son has forever a problem.
Yeah, exactly. I said, oh, okay. And I took it.
You fixed it.
And I fixed it. I gave it to him. I took his tube, probably in that bike. And, and I was like,
I felt
so sad when he left, because the 12-year-old kid even looked sad.
I think the 12-year-old kid would have been happy if his father would show him
how to fix a flat. And maybe even felt bad that he watched his father demean to a fellow human being that I happened to notice kid actually, because you know, he'd been in and out of the shop with his friends. And so, you know, he kind of, everything was awkward about the situation, everything.
And imagine what probably happens then with this kid in 20 years. It might never be able to fix his own wheel and tire and
fix a plumbing leak in his house real quick to get him through the weekend, whatever.
Yeah. So we are always depending to have money to pay someone to do their job. We could easily do ourselves if we just open ourselves to learn it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the thing which is what's completely wrong in society, in the world.
Yeah.
We don't know anymore how to fix anything. So that means as well, we don't know anymore how to fix ourselves. We're broken.
Exactly. You know, because we don't question, to go back to the beginning, instincts, you know, because we still have them. You know, that's how we survive as a human race. So there is an instinct, you know, you see a tiger, you run, you know, something doesn't feel right, you question it. And whatever it be, you know, a government overreach, a law that doesn't feel right, something else that doesn't feel exactly, should I actually be working for this company that sells one of their things is selling arms, you know, and maybe I shouldn't do that. You know, should I eat meat? Should I eat fish? Should I, you know, all of these questions, you know, I'm not saying everyone in the world should be a vegan, a vegetarian, an omnivore, a carnivore, but there's something that feels right in you that we're taught, look, everyone else around us is doing it, so it's fine. But that's not, because we're arriving in a interesting point in time where we live in a beautiful world. I mean, I happen to be so fortunate, living in a fantastic part of the world where people like Maggie and her boyfriend and my daughter and her can come and stay, and my wife's planting trees that we're going to eat the fruit off of it in a couple of years, and we have our own veggies. We're blessed. And if we don't enjoy those blessings, it's almost an affront to those people in this world who are not as blessed as we are. So as we do enjoy our bounty and the beauty around us, I'm conscious that other people are not as blessed. And I spent 3 months of my life in Sierra Leone, Africa, not too long ago, getting bikes to the small villages, being amongst that poverty. And the beauty that is shared amongst that poverty, because they know and they realize on even a more sentient level that every single day is a blessing, because death is around every single doorway, but they don't live in dread of death. They live in joy of life, because tomorrow might be their death. And it's an awakening. Again, I get goosebumps. It's an awakening thing to realize. And that could be any of us. That could be any of us. You know, we had a phone call 2 weeks ago from a friend whose son had a horrible accident, and we thought we were going to be going to a funeral, but fortunately he's walking he's getting better, but that doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
You know, and that awful news, we all knew it. We all said, we all felt awful and we're crying and hugging each other, being there for each other, saying, oh my God, please, please, please. But somebody in that group said, can you imagine though, this is happening around the world every minute, not even every day, every minute someone's getting horrible news, be it from a missed drone strike to an earthquake, to a disease or whatever it is. And we're just fortunate that, you know, now this tragedy touched our life, but we all had to remember, but here we are in this beautiful field and you're giving a concert and we're with each other. And whatever happens, we'll be there for his mom and we'll be there for him, whatever is the turnout of this situation. Mm-hmm. And we have to keep that in mind, because if not, we just let misery and dread guide our lives, or fear. And fear is one of the worst things we could use as a reference, as a guide in our lives. It can never be fear. It has to come from power, from knowledge, and from a place of strength. Then we have the world we want to live in. Then we see poverty disappear. Then we see, you know, other things disappear, because we all have to be strong enough to know, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, but many others maybe not. And maybe one day me, but don't live like that. Live in the power that we have.
There are always two I don't know the word in English now, but two things why we do things,
two reasons.
Mm-hmm. Or it is a negative one, or it is a positive one. I mean, from love or from fear,
right?
And if you do it from fear, we all know that's not a good outcome.
And unfortunately, it's very powerful motivator.
Yes,
all of us, me, you, we're all susceptible to it.
Yes,
fear.
Yeah.
If I listen to fear from the beginning, I never ever would have hopped on that motorcycle in 1983. Because the amount of stories, I wouldn't be sitting here now. I'd be, who knows?
You would not have started the
give it a go. Not written a couple of books. Yes. You know, and yeah, sure, you give up stuff along the way. You make choices. And, you know, okay, we lived without our grandparents around us. Mm. But when our grandparents visited, they came to north of France or Ireland, where I lived for a couple of years, or England or Japan, you know, and it was like, I didn't live in Japan with my family, but yeah, but people
you wrote
visit.
This book mainly as well as a thank you for your mother, right?
Yes, that was that was my thank you card for
why
my
dad?
Well, because my dad died, like I said, 57. So my mom was a bit younger. She was 49. And so it was 4 years later that I left on my journey, and every Italian American family. So a lot of people in my family, not siblings, but like aunts, uncles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I knew there were murmurs in the background. How could Joseph leave his mom? Because my sister was out of the house. My brother was out of the house. I was the youngest. So, you know, I just had to live my life. And my mom looked at me. She was 52, very strong woman. Even during my dad's death, she had a very strong faith mm-hmm. with hell helped her through. And she said, Joe, don't stay here for me. You need to go across America on a motorcycle. Will I worry about you? You're my son. Of course I will. Yeah. You know, but I'm not in this way that I don't want you to go, but just in a parental way, which I didn't understand until I became a parent. You know,
you just cannot feel it.
Exactly. But I did. Yeah. And after all of those years, and then I was a father of two, we moved to this part of the world. And I realized then having two children, and we moved to France, and my life had been so nomadic, I realized what my mother did for me, not giving me that guilt, giving me the ability to go. Even when I met Angie, we got married in England. It was just us. And I called her up and said, oh, sorry, mom, we had a small wedding, but here's your daughter-in-law. You know, and, you know, and we, you know, our children, one of them was born in Brittany in the north while we were living in Brittany. And my mom goes, I don't even know where Brittany is, but I don't know how the heck you make a living, but Joe, I never worry about you. And, you know, those little gifts were the things that enabled me to live my life my way and realize that, you know what, that's what I have to do. So she was coming up to her 80th birthday. She's now 91. So it was coming up to her 80th birthday, and we had 2 years to go. And I was like, Angie, we're living in this beautiful part of the world. I sold a bike shop I had opened in Ireland. And I said, yeah, I'm going to write that book as a thank you to my mom. And I just started writing away. Flew back to New York. I got my old journals, and I just sat down and wrote the book for like 2 years. You know, every day that was my job. Again, of course, we had no debt. Mm-hmm. We were house sitting in exchange for a little work, and so we had a free part in our life, like many of our parts of our life. And I wrote the book, and I gave it to a friend to help me tidy it up a bit. And she was an editor, and she said, Joe, give it to your mom. But this book needs to be out there. Yeah. I'll help you. I'll edit it. I'll help you tidy it up. And, you know, we'll get it more, you know, concise. Well, and that's what she came up with. So, you know,
That's pretty big.
But it is four books. It's four books in one. It recounts like my motorcycle days and then all three of the separate journeys that added up to like 14 years, basically, of being on the road. And it's called Cycles of a Traveler because those 14 years represented two cycles of my life, you know, 7, 14, 21, the 7-year cycle of
your
life.
You're cycling on the bike. How many years did you cycle?
I was on the bike about 9 years. Yeah. Well, I'm still cycling on it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But 9 years, we have been around the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, around the world. Yeah, a lot of people, you know, they like to ask me, oh, and then you cycle here. I was like, I went where the bike took me, you know, and, you know, if I hit every country and it took the occasional airplane or a ferry, I was cool with that. I was a traveler. My bicycle was a mode to travel.
Yeah.
And yeah, and it was a great thing. And yeah, the thank you note was because that. And then I learned from my mom to do the same with our kids when we raised them. You know, when they wanted to stop school, we supported them. And, you know, they both live in, we were filled with fear living in France. They're very education orientated. And when the kids left school at an age that is deemed, you know, it's legal, but deemed young, of course, you still have to be, you know, sculpted into what society wants you to be. We just said, well, you know, both of them aren't into it. And
I get it. Yeah. I mean, your daughter's a friend of mine, Chess, and she's really like, she's 7 years old.
17.
17, yes.
Yeah. Not 17. Seven, not seven.
17 years old. And I have to say, when I speak to her, I can speak to her like I speak to you. Her mindset is so big, and she saw so many things in life already with her age. And it's beautiful to have young people being really, really feeling life and not just following, like we were talking at the beginning. So now we make a cycle again back to where we started our talk.
Yeah.
she represents so much of your lifestyle too, and she shows that she's like an example for me. If I would have been able to be like so open minded at 17, I would be really happy.
Well, and she's an example for me, as is my son. They're following their paths, and it's an example of. We let go at it early. Like when we found out Angie was pregnant, Angie and I were in the middle of a bicycle tour in Holland somewhere. And we're like, okay, let's be parents. You know, so that's why we decided to come to France. A friend said, oh, I have a house that needs renovation for your first year of life as parents. Maybe you want to do that, you know, do a little DIY work and you can spend all the time you want. And so all of those things led us to become almost full-time parents, both of us.
Do you think the life is coming how it should come?
Yeah.
How do you have the feeling that it's providing the things with?
Like meeting those guys, in the petrol station in Oregon.
Yeah.
That's how my life unfolded. You know, I knew I had to break out of my cross country motorcycle habit, but I didn't know how. I was just a guy from the Bronx, and then I went the next year. I took a ride up to Alaska on my motorcycle from New York, which was in the 885, and I still was going, I guess I'll go back to New York now because I had become a school teacher because I had a college education. I was like, I liked the job; it was interesting, but I wasn't feeling it. And the universe put me in a dune buggy that I flipped over, broke my wrist, and I had to stay on the West Coast.
So it was a good thing.
It was a good thing. I had to heal on the West Coast, stayed on the West Coast. I spoke Spanish, met some Guatemalan guys who said, we were on a work site together, and they were like, what are you doing? You're going across America on a motorcycle. You speak Spanish, come down to Guatemala. Interesting, blah, blah. I was like, okay.
Okay.
And so I did. And that opened me up. I met some travelers, some long-term world travelers, and said to myself, wow, you've been on the road how long? 3 years? You worked in Japan teaching English? Tell me more. And that's it. All he had to do was say that. And I limped home after that. I was, again, broke, and I stayed on the West Coast, and I made it back to New York, and I was like, I'm going to Japan teaching. My friends and family were like, Joe, you live in California now. You've been across America. You've been up to Alaska on your motorcycle. Are you done? I said, yeah, I am. And they all breathed a sigh of relief. I said, yeah, I'm going to Japan now. But my mom was there. My mom was there.
She
came to visit me in Japan. And after Japan, I wound up living in Australia before I even made it back home. And what did she do? She got one of her sisters and my nephew at the time and took him to Australia. And we rented used cars. I never had money. We slept on floors. I give up my bed. I sleep on a floor. But it was an adventure that they couldn't have afforded. I said, just get plane tickets. The rest we'll create. And
it happened.
And we created it.
And I think that's what I really wanted to share as well through your story today with the community, sales planning community, that we are many times so, and I feel it for myself too, we are so much into the things that we don't see what is around it sometimes. So we try, sometimes we have a vision, which is great. To have a vision is beautiful. But sometimes we follow things too blind without seeing the big thing, what is possible. And sometimes things, let them just happen.
Right. Have the vision, but make it this wide.
Yes.
It's there, it's there somewhere. If that's what you want to do, great. But if you meet someone on the way to that vision and they say, whatever, come to Guatemala or do this, or have you ever tried that? Try it, try it. The worst it could be is not the best month of your life.
Yes.
And then, but then that's where you go to your instincts and go, do I want to do this? Can I change? Do I have the strength to change?
Yeah.
And of course you do, because it's been tapped out of us. It's been tapped out of us. Schooling is not what it is really meant. It is what it was meant to be. It was meant to raise people to, especially the higher education, to get to managers, to produce good managers, universities a lot of time, to produce, nurses, doctors. Yeah, that's all great. But we can't forget that nurses and doctors are one path to health. There's Chinese medicine, there's homeopathy. There's so many lines to health. And that's one way. And that's, if you want to do that, that's great. If you want to be a nurse, if you want to be a doctor, if you want to be, but if you want, if you're not sure you want to be, you don't need to sit in a college room for 4 years to say, I want to be a carpenter. I've always wanted to be a carpenter, but go to college, but I want to go be a carpenter, so it's like, but we don't get that, because I've had so many conversations over the years where I would ask, so why are you sending, your daughter to university? Because she's really, she kind of likes this, and but all the friends are going to university. And I was like, yeah, but that's not really a reason to do things. Why don't you just put her, instead of spending 20 grand a year on university, why don't you spend 6 grand, put her in a small town, pay her rent, 6 grand for the year, get her a small apartment, and say, survive. Mm-hmm. See what you're gonna do. See what
Learn
you want to do.
Learn life.
You know, do it for a year. What's gonna happen? Yeah. You know, at 18 years old, they're gonna get a job and maybe be a waitress and say, oh, I don't want to do that. And maybe
sometimes it's important to know what you don't want.
I think it's more important to know what you don't want.
To do what you really
sure.
want.
Sure. Unfortunately, a lot of people find out what they don't want, yeah. and 30 years later they say, ah.
But then
I'm getting out now.
Yes,
no, 30 then, years later.
Yes. And
yeah.
then it's never too late. But then it's for the most.
But it's much
they
harder.
They feel it is too late, and then they don't even start it.
And if you live the prescribed life for 30 years, which again, I'm not downplaying. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying this is how society runs. This is what we're in. But we need to change that paradigm. We need to shift because it's not obviously doing well. Because we could look around with all the addictions, be it drug, opioids, computers, or phones. There's too many addictions. You know. Getting us through life and not enough time richness and cash poorness.
Yeah.
We focus too much on the money richness and the material richness, but the time richness is that untenable, but way more profitable to a healthy lifestyle. Everything that you read says, get rid of stress out of your life. How do we deal with disease? We deal so much better in a stress-free environment.
And healthy, like healthy, mentally healthy. And of course, physically, but healthy mentally is a big thing that we forget.
Thing.
And that is what, again, too much time on just screens and not having interactions with people makes us as well sick. It's not healthy for us. Well, we are quite. Last question.
I'll keep it quick. I promise. I'll keep it quick.
What do you think about hope? I mean, you do a lot of, like, you live a very sustainable lifestyle. What is your opinion on how will the world move on? Do you have hope? You're an optimistic person.
I do have hope.
Yeah,
I do have hope. I always have. Even though, you know, sometimes I can feel things are crumbling and the point in time we're in right now, sometimes I've, like you said, I do write a blog and I've lost friends over my opinions on some stuff. And, you know, it is tough, but I do have hope that one day we'll get rid of the divisiveness that now keeps us apart, because we'll have to see one day that it's not good. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this helps to open conversation to someone who doesn't share your opinion. We need to talk to people who don't share our opinions. This is what we need. I could talk to people, share my opinions all day. It's great. But to talk to people, talk to them, not fight with them.
Yeah.
Not argue with them, not have that again, that
Learn
that boot, that boot, sorry, French, that goal, that goal of, well, the whole purpose of this conversation is to change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work. Yeah, the whole point of this conversation is to know your mind.
Yes.
And you to know my
and
mind.
To learn a different
and
opinion.
Exactly.
And a different point
and
of
maybe
view.
Something you say will say, interesting, I'll look into that.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't believe it. Oh, wow, actually, I never saw that, never heard of that. So we need to be open to change. Change is what I'm hopeful about. The only constant in life is change.
Yeah.
And you could try to hide from that fact. I don't care if you work in an office building in New York or if you're in South Tyrol in a conservative village. Look around you. Change happens minutely, every second. You know, and we go through the seasonal changes and we go through life changes and life on our planet changes. So I'm hopeful that, we're in a turbulent period, Maggie. We're in a very turbulent period in many, many facets of our life. We will get through it. Does it mean humanity might diminish in population? Does it mean life as we know it might change drastically to the life we knew 2 years ago? Quite possibly does. It quite possibly does. But we have to keep that perspective of life and death as well, and get rid of the fear of death, and reinstall the joy of living, and then we don't fear death, and then we just live every day of our life in joy, and in power and in strength.
Yes, give it a go. Exactly. I think this is a really beautiful, beautiful ending of this podcast.
Yes.
Just check it out, this campaign. And now, at the end of the podcast, you know even more why I have this beautiful interview with this beautiful man here. Give it a go, guys. Talk with your neighbors. Talk with the people you meet on the street.
Yes.
And just open yourself for other opinions. I think that's one of the biggest starts we really need to have a healthy, sanus planet. It's about health mindset too, and it's about opening ourselves for different point of views. Even though if we don't agree, that's okay. We might never agree with everything, but
The biggest takeaway, the biggest takeaway I want to give you is there's no mistakes. We just continue changing, learning, and moving on.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Be healthy.
Yeah.